We all know the subject of environment is not restricted to a study in a place of worship. And we know our newspapers and all type of media speak of this and the concern of all people, especially the leaders of the land. So we have an interesting approach to it this evening. Our brother Stephen Snowblin will lead us in the Bible and the environment. Let's see.
Thanks, Brother Mark. Good evening, everyone. Before I begin our consideration of this topic, I just wanted to offer some qualifications to some of my comments from Sunday morning. A few people after I gave my exhortation on Sunday morning made some jokes about me asking everyone to increase their birth rates and that sort of thing. I wasn't exactly saying that, although it has to be said that healthy families, largest families, are biblical. And in all seriousness, if we as a community follow the trends of the Western world, which is declining birth rates, in fact, in many countries below replacement, then we're going to see ourselves in a downward spiral as well. And that's if we retain all of our young people, and if we don't, then it's going to be a lot worse. And you look around at some of the more liberal churches around us, we see that they're losing members left and right, and their young people just aren't coming in. So it's a concern, particularly for an ecclesia that tends to be traditionally a little bit demographically top-heavy. We've got to make sure that the numbers are there, that we have the young people, and also that these young people are trained and are biblically sound to sort of take over the helm when the older generation passes off the scene. And this is very, very important. I mean, do we have young people? Are we raising young people that are able to deal with some of the challenging the traditional questions, you know, questions about the Trinity? Do we have the ability to defend ourselves against some of the doctrines that we see around us or some of the very difficult questions like that are often thrown about, such as the argument that the Bible, the Old Testament, teaches genocide, right? Some of these really difficult questions. Or our topic today, which is a very contemporary one, the Bible and the environment. What does the Bible say about that? We need to be up to date on what the world around us and other religious people are speaking about as much as possible, so that we have that kind of response. So that was sort of the intent of what I was saying. And it is also the case that you can do everything right and still lose your children. It's not necessarily your fault. There can be other factors, including perhaps some hypocrisy in the ecclesia. We have to be careful that we don't hurt people and so on and so forth. So it's not necessarily our fault if we do lose our young people, but we have to obviously try our best to make sure that that doesn't happen. Okay, I want to begin with an anecdote which was recorded in a book on the environment about James Watt, who was the first Reagan-era Secretary of the Interior. And this takes us back to the early 1980s. And in fact, February 5th, 1981, would be very early in the administration of Ronald Reagan. So the quotation is as follows. A famous proponent of this perspective, the perspective that we're going to leave the earth, we're going to go to heaven, Christ is going to come back, take us away, and the earth is going to be perhaps destroyed. Right, this is what this author is speaking about. A famous proponent of this perspective is James Watt, the first Reagan-era Secretary of the Interior. In response to a question during the discussion on February 5, 1981, with a committee of the House of Representatives as to why his agency was acting contrary to his expressed mandate, Watt, a devout Christian, and this means an evangelical Christian of a particular type, said, "I do not know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns." What is he saying? He's saying Christ's return is perhaps just around the corner. So how concerned do we need to be about the environment? Because after all, either Christ is going to set it right, or it doesn't really matter because the earth's going to be destroyed and we're going to be taken away and we're going to go to heaven where we won't be affected by conditions on the earth. So this author explains it in this way. In other words, since Jesus is coming back soon, and since when Jesus returns, everything will be destroyed, that's actually not an uncommon idea in some Christian circles. Why care about the earth? Yosemite or Yellowstone, Isle Royale, which is in Lake Superior, or the Everglades, the park down the street, the local river or stream, your backyard. The popularity of books written by contemporary rapture advocating writers Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye attests to the allure of this eschatology. And we've probably all encountered this rather ridiculous, I think I can call it that in all fairness, although very popular, series of books called the Left Behind series. And the basic premise of this series, of course, is the rapture, that Christ comes back, takes his people away with him, and ultimately the traditional rapture teaching has it that we're going to go to heaven, we're going to be taken to heaven, and we're going to join believers already in heaven, and the earth is going to be burned up based on an incorrect reading of 2 Peter 3. And so therefore, what happens with the environment doesn't really matter. So this is interesting because, as we can see, our eschatology can actually relate to how we view nature around us. And this is a theme that I want to return to a couple times in our presentation this evening. So although discussions about the Bible and the environment may not be something that we have traditionally dealt with from this platform or in Christadelphia in general, the issues that we're dealing with here, biblical issues and also doctrinal issues that are presented by those around us, they do link up with some things that we know a lot about, or at least we should. Eschatology, by the way, is a fancy, highfalutin word for teachings about the end time. Eschaton is the Greek word for last, so the things that happen in the last times. So that's what eschatology means. Okay, now, so on the one hand, you have a large section of Christians, including evangelical Christians and other sorts of Christians, who say in varying degrees that it doesn't really matter what's happening with the earth because Christ is going to come back and he's going to set everything right, or he's going to take us away and the earth's going to be burned up. You have that perspective in the Christian world. It's not universal. I'll touch on I'll say something about that in a few moments. So you have that interesting trend. But then in the secular world, obviously, there's a huge environmental movement. And not everyone in the environmental movement is secular. There are actually lots of religious people in the environmental movement. But I just want to make a general point about the importance of environmentalism in the secular world. So what I'm showing here on the screen right now is the Eden Project in Cornwall in England. And back in 2001, when my parents came to visit us in England shortly before we left, we went down and visited the Eden Project and went inside those biospheres. And the point I want to make is that this project is called the Eden Project, and that term, Eden, obviously comes from the Bible. You can see some more pictures. This is from the outside, an aerial photograph, and some pictures inside. I think these pictures were taken fairly early in the history of the Eden Project. I think the foliage, the trees and that sort of thing are a little bit bigger and lusher now. Here's a book that they produced, Plants of Eden, and they're trying to educate the public about the environment, about plants, about the role they play in our lives, that, for example, our clothes often, cotton, etc., linen come from plants, but also that without plants, we wouldn't be able to survive. We wouldn't last very long at all. But again, this image, this language of Eden is used. And so the mission director, Tony Kendall, has this to say about the symbol of the Garden of Eden. The original Garden of Eden is a symbol of paradise, but also of mankind's rejection from it. Historically, conservation policies have also assumed that the best quality environments are touched by people and that environmental care meant keeping people out of them. The real situation is more complex than that, particularly now that the environment is partly damaged. It's actually necessary for humans to get involved in the environment, to try to correct some of the damage that has been done. And so what he's moving towards here is a discussion of what is often referred to as a stewardship model. Humans have caused lots of problems with the world, but there are also places where we have lived in harmony with nature without complete destruction, sometimes with a beneficial effect. Many of the challenges that lie ahead can only be met by people being there, not by their walking away. So there's a difference between a passive response and an active response. Communities have already begun to take steps to be effective stewards of the world. The Eden Project is here to showcase those steps. Now, I'm not sure how much this particular person here is evoking the biblical role of the steward, but of course, it does come up throughout the Bible. Firstly, we're presented in Genesis chapter 1 and in Genesis chapter 2 with this notion of dominion, that Adam and Eve and the early humans were given dominion over the earth. And we'll talk about this in a few moments, but I have presented on the handout some ideas that come out of the Genesis creation account that point towards this stewardship model, right? So how do we respond to the environment? Do we just sort of escape it and not do anything at all? Or do we fulfill the role of a steward and involve ourselves in a benign and beneficial way? The model that Genesis chapter 2 presents to us is that of benign involvement, right? Not passive neglect, but benign involvement. That is to say, involvement in nature to keep it on track and to make it better if there has been some damage. Of course, there are some parables about stewards in the New Testament. And it's interesting that when you look at the history of biology and the history of the environmental sciences, that the notion of nature as an economy, right, this word oikonomia, which is Greek and is found in the Bible, was used in the early modern period much like we would use the word system. An economy was a system, and they talked about a theological economy, so a theological system. But also, Carl Linnaeus, who was the one who came up with the binomial nomenclature system, he was a Lutheran, the son of a Lutheran minister, and he was motivated to study nature by the Genesis creation account. He saw himself as a kind of a new Adam, not in the spiritual sense, in the New Testament sense, but in that he was fulfilling a very similar role to Adam in naming animals. That's what Carl Linnaeus did. He named animals, he named plants. So he began to use this term economy, economia, to apply to nature, and it came from his understanding of creation as an interconnected system, which is exactly what we have in Genesis chapter 1, also in Genesis chapter 2, but particularly in Genesis chapter 1. Later on, the word ecology is coined on the basis of that original concept of economy. It's a very similar word. In fact, the first root, EC, is the same. It comes from the Greek word oikos, for house. An economy, in the biblical sense, is the management of the house or the household laws or rules. So our notion of the environment as an interconnected system historically in the West comes in part, not entirely, but in part from the biblical notion of creation, right? So that's something that is worth noting if you ever have a discussion with someone about the environment. That and you can take my word for it. This is my job. I teach history of science. This is absolutely the case, and it's taught in history of science classes by people who aren't even religious. So we looked at an example of the word Eden being used for an environmental project. Here's another one, an attempt to record and identify all the species of the earth, partly before some of them become extinct. And so this cover from New Scientist magazine uses the term ark. And, of course, the allusion is to Noah's Ark, right? So the point I'm making here, that's amazing artwork, by the way. I'm sure you'll agree with me, the barcode and the zebra. But the idea here is that the ark was, in large part, meant to preserve animals. And this is something that is pointed out on the handout as well, that God asked Noah to preserve the unclean animals as well as the clean animals, right? So we get a sense here that the created species are good and that they need to be preserved. So we get this image from the story of Noah's Ark, which we learn as children. And this idea of Noah's Ark and the preservation of animals, abstracted from the biblical context, is actually used by environmentalists, right? So there's another positive example of a biblical metaphor being used by environmentalists. Another example, the frozen ark, and this is an attempt to freeze genetic material from animals, again, so that if they become extinct, we would have some genetic record of them. Again, the allusion here is to Noah's Ark, right? It's absolutely the case that is what they're referring to. Now, last year when I was, I visited Israel in June of last year, and the LL In Flight magazine had this very interesting advertisement. If we can make the desert bloom, we can find a cure for cancer. And this is Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. So they're trying to develop the Negev, which is the southern portion of Israel, which traditionally has been a desert area. And they're literally making the desert bloom. But obviously, this language comes from what Jews would call the Tanakh, what we would call the Old Testament, Isaiah 35. So this positive imagery from the Bible is actually being used and appropriated, in some cases, by people who aren't religious, in some case, by people who are religious. I'm not sure if these people are religious or not, but certainly they would know their Bibles because the Bible is fairly important even to secular people in Israel. Okay, now I'm pointing this out because there's also an argument that Christianity and the Bible have actually been historically harmful to the environment. That there are ideas in the Bible that have led to today's ecological crisis, right? This idea has been around certainly since the 1960s when Lynn White Jr., that's Lynn as a he, not a she, Lynn White Jr., The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis, published in a very mainstream science journal, which still exists today, it's just called Science, 1967. And this thesis is now called the White Thesis, is often discussed by historians, by scientists, by ecologists, and by people who believe in the Bible. Is this really true? Now, White is arguing chiefly that this notion of dominion that we have in the Genesis account of creation is a notion of domination. And it's all about the rape and the destruction and the exploitation of the environment, of nature, that nature is an object and it is there for us to abuse and do with what we like. Now, the Bible doesn't teach that, and as I move on, I'll try to argue that point. But it's very important to know that this argument is out there. Now, this argument has been summarized by a Christian scholar who has responded to it in the following way. The first point is that monotheism in general, and Christianity in particular, is the primary, if not sole cause, of the despoliation of the earth. That's a pretty bold and provocative claim. Many people accept it. The emphasis within the Christian tradition on dualisms of soul and body, spirit and matter, denigrates the earth and sanctions its misuse and exploitation. We'll return to dualism a little bit later. A third argument, often cited by critics, derives from perceived inadequacies in Christian eschatology. I've already defined eschatology for you, so I don't need to explain that word. Fourthly and finally, and this is a reference to Lynn White and the White thesis, medieval historian, which means he studies the medieval period, not that he lived in the medieval period, Lynn White Jr., in his famous and oft-reprinted 1967 essay, The Historical Roots of our Ecologic Crisis, claims that because of its role in the rise of modern science and technology, Christianity bears a huge burden of guilt for the present situation. Now, that's a pretty bold claim, as I said, and if it's true, then obviously it would cause lots of problems, not just guilt, but other problems for Christians. If God really exists and he really inspired the Bible and he really created the earth, then why would he have created a Bible, that document that actually led to the destruction of the earth? Well, one scholar who has criticized White has summarized his view in this way, that you have the Judeo-Christian tradition and its teachings, which include this notion of dominion as domination. Right? Dominion as domination, as presented in Genesis 1, but also Genesis 2. This leads to the development of science and technology, which in turn lead to environmental degradation when science and technology are driven by this kind of thinking that I've mentioned before, dominion as domination. Now, this chap, Moncrief, who has criticized White, has argued that actually the situation is much more complicated. You move from the Judeo-Christian tradition to capitalism with the attendant development of science and technology, democratization, and then you move on to a third stage, urbanization, increased wealth, increased population, individual resource ownership, and then a fourth stage, environmental degradation. And by the time you get to that stage, Christianity is not really a major factor in this. In fact, this can be qualified even more. Now, I'm not going to say this evening that the Judeo-Christian tradition is not guilty at all, that it is free from guilt from the present environmental crisis. I'm not going to say that at all, because I think there is some truth in this claim. But we can separate, we certainly can separate Christianity, what we could even call Christendom, from what the Bible is teaching, because those aren't necessarily always exactly the same thing. Okay, another critic, Christian critic of White, has made the following claims. He argues that White's critique, number one, tends to reduce the explanation of the complex ecological crisis to a single cause, Christianity. Number two, to exaggerate the authority of Christianity in cultures. One of the early respondents in the journal Science to White's thesis made a rather amusing comment in that he said that Christianity must be a lot older than we have often assumed, because clearly it must have also been responsible for the megafauna extinctions in the in around 10,000 BC. And that's a point I'm going to return to. Number three, tends to minimize the fact that non-Christian cultures have also been environmental despoilers, and two and three obviously relate. Number three, tends to overlook the number of dissenting opinions in Christian history. White's thesis, now it was a short article, so we have to make allowances for that, but nevertheless, White's thesis tends to treat Christianity and people who believe in the Bible as a monolith, when of course we know that that is just not the case. Christianity is very diverse. Those who call themselves Christians have very diverse ideas. Number five, it tends to underestimate the potential for ecological reform in Christianity, although White actually did allow for that possibility. Okay. Now, some recent studies that have looked at the history of the environment, the history of human attitudes about the environment, have shown, number one, that Western religion, including Christianity and culture, have not been as hostile to the environment as claimed, as hostile to the environment as claimed by some. And number two, non-Western religion and culture have not been as gentle on the environment as claimed by some. And we can summarize this by saying every culture has an imperfect record. Human nature persists despite the ideals of the world religions. So the problem, I think, with the environment and with man's interaction with the environment boils down to not a particular religion or a particular religious outlook, but something a lot more basic than that, and we call that human greed and lack of foresight. And that is shared by everyone, whether they're whatever religion they are or if they're secular. Okay, now, the idea that Christianity is to blame for the ecological crisis can be countered, as we've already pointed out, by the fact that non-Christian, in fact, many pre-Christian cultures and societies have treated the environment very poorly indeed. So the Pleistocene extinctions, 11,000 to 10,000 years ago, of megafauna in North America. Megafauna, these are the giant beavers, the Irish elk, those large creatures which don't exist anymore, caused partly by climate change and also by overhunting by Paleo-Indians. Now, someone a number of years ago wrote a book called The Myth of the Ecological Indian. And there's this sort of myth that Native Americans and other pre-modern cultures were actually very gentle on the environment. Well, research has shown that, they also, in many cases, lacked foresight and drove certain animals to extinction, etc. Ancient Mesopotamia, this is a situation that relates more to biblical history, canal siltation and topsoil salination due to improper irrigation techniques in the Tigris and Euphrates river systems. The Anasazi Indians of the Chaco Canyon, this is around 1100 AD, deforestation leading to the erosion of their fields and the demise of their crop production. A very well-known example, Easter Island. By the time of European contact, the islanders were clinging to existence after denuding the island of trees and other biota, forms of life, in the pursuit of religious ideals. Right? They were creating these, and there's Easter Island, and you've all seen those large carvings. They look kind of like idols. They're all very similar. They devoted all of their economies and their effort, their resources, and their time to creating these large carvings, these large monoliths, to appease their gods. And to do that, they had to cut down all the trees. And eventually, by the time Europeans arrived, there weren't any trees on the island. And the population was in a downward spiral. And this was because of a distorted religious ideal that they had. So it is the case that religion can have, in certain examples, a negative impact on the environment. The case of Easter Island is an example of that, a very poignant one. Now, there are examples of people who believed in the Bible in history who had more positive attitudes towards the environment. Now, this quotation, I want to qualify it, but it is an interesting one. I want to give you three examples from Judaism. Medieval Judaism. So this text says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say, if you have a sapling in your hand and someone should say to you that the Messiah has come, stay and complete the planting and then go to greet the Messiah. Now, if we translate this into our context, of course we believe that Christ is the Messiah, but we refer to Christ in this sense. I'm not going to suggest that if we hear that Christ has returned and we're planting a tree that we should finish planting the tree. I think that may be going against the Christ's own teachings. But nevertheless, aside from that, here we see a Jewish rabbi arguing that planting trees is very important. This is from the Leviticus Rabbah. This is from the even before the Middle Ages. How can a person of flesh and blood follow God? God, from the very beginning of creation, was occupied before all else with planting. I've got some examples on the handout of this for you. As it is written, and first of all, the eternal God planted a garden in Eden. Therefore, occupy yourselves first and foremost with planting. So, good occupation? Landscaping. But the point is that this Jewish text here sees the importance of planting. Planting trees, planting other sorts of vegetation. Moses Maimonides, a Jewish philosopher from the High Middle Ages, wrote, in order to serve God, one needs access to the enjoyment of the beauties of nature, such as the contemplation of flower-decorated meadows, majestic mountains, flowing rivers. For all these are essential to the spiritual development of even the holiest of people. And so here is something a little bit different. The idea that the beauty of nature can actually have spiritual benefits. Now, these Jewish sources, I'm using them because they are based on responses to what we call the Old Testament, right? They call it the Bible or the Tanakh, the Hebrew Scriptures. And so clearly, even though White is arguing that the Bible generally has a hostile view of the environment, clearly there were thinkers going right back to the early centuries of our era in the Jewish tradition who were able to develop a positive view about the environment on the basis of their reading of God's Word. Okay, now, I mentioned earlier that not all Christians share this idea that we're going to be taken from the earth and the earth is going to be destroyed, we're going to be raptured, and it doesn't really matter what happens to the earth. They don't all believe this. In fact, there are some Christians, including some, not all, but some evangelicals who argue against this particular view. Now, why mention evangelicals? Well, partly just for historical reasons, but also because evangelicals tend to have a very similar view of the Bible and inspiration to us. So they generally do believe that the Bible is the Word of God, so they take it seriously. So they're much more oriented towards the Bible than, say, Catholics or United Church members, et cetera, et cetera. Now, obviously, we don't agree with much of what they teach. We agree with some of it, but much we don't. But we do tend to have a very similar view of inspiration. So it's useful to look at those evangelical analogies for that reason. In this book by Stephen Bomer Prediger, and actually when a number of years ago, he's actually a professor at a university in Michigan, came to Dalhousie, and I was involved in a talk that he was giving. And he gave an amazing talk. It was very difficult for him because the very beginning of his talk, for about 20 minutes, there was a punk rock band in the next room playing. And he said, I really would prefer Handel's Messiah in the background, but he wasn't given the choice. And anyways, the loud, rather jarring music ended eventually. But he made a number of very interesting points, and I went up to him afterwards and had a chat with him, because one of the things he said is that one of the problems that many Christians have with the environment relates to their notion of a soul. What did he mean by that? Well, this idea, and I've already referred to it, that when you die, the soul leaves the body and you go to heaven. Right? So if that's the case, who cares about what happens to the earth, right? Because you're going to a place that is impervious to the kind of destruction that we're seeing on this earth now. So he made a big point about this, and he also said this idea that we're going to heaven when we die and that we're not going to be on the earth in the millennium, so that's unbiblical. And Christians who teach that are wrong. And not only that, but they're contributing to negative ideas about the environment. I couldn't believe that this chap was saying all those things. He kind of ruined it, partly by advocating the Trinity in his talk. But I went up to him afterwards and I said, how do you survive in your evangelical world with those views? He says, well, actually, an increasing number of evangelicals have this view of the soul, very similar to our own. And it's a bit of a surprise, I guess. I was aware of it, but I think in general it's probably a bit of a surprise to us that this is actually happening, that evangelicals, some of them, actually have, in increasing numbers, the same view of the soul as us. We need to be aware of this, and I think it's something that we can capitalize on when we're interacting with them. Another evangelical who made a very similar point, Calvin DeWitt, wrote this: saving people out of creation has roots in the Platonic idea that physical nature is a source of ignorance and evil and is a snare to the soul, joined with ideas of human transcendence. This results in a theology which stresses salvation of the soul, dismissing as insignificant the body and the creation of which it was a part. The Bible does not make this distinction between the physical and the spiritual. And this is quite amazing, because this is roughly what John Thomas and Robert Roberts and Christendom Astray, for example, were teaching way back in the Victorian period. And it seems that some people have been reading their Bibles very carefully and have come to realize that the notion of a soul that leaves the body is Platonic, and it's been foisted on the Bible without warrant. But this idea, it seems, from what this chap is saying, and certainly this makes sense, is related to negative ideas about the environment. And he argues for the de-Platonizing of biblical theology. Now, unfortunately, these people don't want to take this all the way, because if they did, they would get rid of the Trinity as well and some other things. But nevertheless, it is interesting to see some Christians, and I've encountered many myself, who have very similar, if not exactly the same, view of the soul as us. Okay, now, as I've been suggesting, one of the problems is this kind of Platonic dualism. It's also associated in a more radical form with what is called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is often talked about today. It's a very contemporary topic. And one of the teachings of Gnosticism is that you want to escape this physical world because the physical world is negative. Now, that is absolutely not what is taught in Genesis chapter 1. 7 times it says, and God saw that it was good. And the 7th time is emphatic. God saw that it was very good, right? And it was very good. But the Gnostics taught that the material world was created by an evil God. And we want to associate ourselves with the good God, and Christian Gnostics associated the good God with Christ. And you want to sort of hop off this material plane of existence and go into a spiritual plane of existence where you don't have to worry about the body decaying and the earth decaying, because the spiritual plane of existence is impervious to all those sorts of things. So, forms of Christianity and Judaism and Islam influenced by Platonic and Gnostic modes of thought are likely to encourage harmful attitudes toward nature because, 1, Platonic Gnostic modes of thought derogate the material world. And as I said, some forms of Gnosticism assert that the material world is actually created by an evil God. 2, Platonic Gnostic modes of thought teach that the ultimate goal of individual humans is to transcend the physical world and attain status in a purely physical realm. The physical world will be left behind or destroyed. So this is one of the problems with with mainstream Christianity and Judaism and Islam, is that they have these Platonic notions of the soul and Platonic notions of reality, that the earth and our bodies, they don't really matter, right? So it doesn't matter how you treat them, because the goal is to go to that spiritual realm. These are ideas that are completely unbiblical. The Bible teaches that we are bodies, right? When we die, all of us is dead, not part of us, but all of us is dead. And that's the logic of the resurrection, right? That you need to be raised, because the only life that's countenanced in the Bible is embodied life, right? There's no discussion about souls floating off to heaven without their bodies. You don't find that in the Bible. You find that in later Platonized versions of Christianity and Judaism, but you don't find that in the Bible. Similarly, we don't have discussions about two worlds, a physical world and then another world, spiritual world, to which souls go. Yes, there is heaven where God dwells, and God also dwells everywhere, obviously. But this notion of a heaven as a destination point for believers is also unbiblical. So we can see in the microcosm of the body and the macrocosm of the universe, these dualistic modes of thought have infiltrated Christianity to ill effect. So we talked about James Watt's view, his kind of apocalyptic view, that Christ is going to return, the earth is going to be destroyed. Well, there's another apocalyptic view, which is, I think, more biblical, and it comes in Revelation chapter 11. And the nations were angry, and thy wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, small and great, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. Now, this has a particular context, but it's interesting language. And it's language that I think should cause us, should lead us to consider just how we interact, how we treat the earth. We certainly don't want to be, in any sense, amongst those who destroy the earth. Okay, so I want to make a number of points. The argument against Platonic and Gnostic forms of Christianity and Judaism and Islam that I've shown you from a couple of evangelical thinkers, that argument is an argument that we should be making. It's an argument that we could have made 150 years ago, right? It's perfectly consistent with our teaching, our biblical view of the soul. So this is something I think that we should be talking about. Something else to think about. Can we preach against man's destruction of the environment? And certainly we do, and that message has been preached from this platform. And view the environmental crisis as a sign of the times, and continue blindly to contribute to it ourselves. Third point. If we believe nature is God's creation, can we knowingly destroy it? And fourth point. If we believe in eternal life on earth rather than in heaven, can we disregard the way we treat the earth? Now, this is something that is important for us, because here we can see that our eschatology, our teaching about the end times, our teaching about the future, actually can lead to a very positive view of nature, right? Because this earth is where we're going to be in the millennium, right? This is where we're going to be by God's grace. We're not going to heaven. We don't believe we're going to heaven. The Bible doesn't teach that. So here we can see how our biblical notions of the future link nicely with a positive view of the environment. And this is something that we should talk about to our friends. You know, this is what we believe. We don't believe the earth's going to be destroyed. We don't believe we're leaving the earth. We believe we're going to be on the earth, right? And you can be too. Therefore, we need to treat the earth in a positive way. Now, do we want to live in a world like this, or a world that is beautiful like this? These are some pictures from the West Coast, one of which I did not take. Right, and that's a beach out by Souk. Now, at this point, I'd like to direct your attention to the handout, The Bible and the Environment. Now, what I've done here is I've set out some examples from the first page from the book of Genesis, from the early chapters of Genesis, where we see a view of the environment being laid out for us by God in his word. Now, the first point is about the two triads of creation. Some of you would have been here a couple of years ago when I presented some ideas about the Genesis creation account. You may remember that the 6 days are set up as two triads. Days 1, 2, and 3 are days of forming, and days 4, 5, and 6 are days of filling. And day 1 and 4, 2 and 5, 3 and 6 relate in a very interesting way, because as the first bullet point mentions, we have the creation of habitats on days 1 to 3, and then on days 4 to 6, inhabitants, counting the sun, moon, and stars as sort of inhabitants of the realm of light created on day 1. And as I said earlier, this notion of an interconnected creation where God has created the habitats and then the inhabitants to go in them, and those inhabitants are designed to operate within their various habitats or environments. So you have fish that can swim for the ocean, land creatures that can walk on the land, and birds that can fly to operate in the air, right? So each of those three forms of locomotion are adapted to those three realms of creation. So these ideas that we find in Genesis chapter 1 that Carl Linnaeus, the founder of the binomial nomenclature system, and other early thinkers about the environment based their notion of the environment as an interconnected system on, right? We see the hand of God at work. We see his foresight in creating nature as interconnected and interdependent, as a system, as an economy. Okay, we see one of the Hebrew words for the first time, the word green, appears in the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. That's just kind of an interesting point. And as I mentioned earlier, the created world is described as good, and finally the seventh time as very good. And we can see this in Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. So there's no idea here that the world is evil, that the material world is evil. That's a Gnostic idea. That's an unhealthy idea that comes from outside the Bible, and unfortunately in some cases has been foisted on the Bible without biblical warrant. The aesthetics of creation, it's not just good, but if you look at verse 9 of chapter 2, which was read for us earlier, we can see that the trees of Eden are described first as beautiful and then as good for food. And this tells us something about God's love for us, obviously, in providing us with a beautiful world and with food that is good to eat and so on. We also see, and this is a theme that we've touched on already, that humans are, they're created in the image of God, Imago Dei, that's image of God, but they also have the responsibilities that come with that status, right? That we are the only creatures that can actually sit around like we are right now and talk about the environment, right? Cows don't do it. Horses don't do it. We're the only creatures that can do it. We're the only creatures that can ruin the environment consciously, and we're also the only creatures that can save it and help it, right? We have a God-like status in creation. We're not gods, obviously, but we're made in the image of God. So we have some responsibilities that the animals do not have. We see that humans have a bond with the earth in that they come out of the earth, right? Although we are created in the image of God and we have a relationship with God that is not shared with animals, we also have a relationship with the earth around us because we come from the earth, and if we die before Christ returns, we go back to the earth. So it's humbling, but it's an important biblical theme, obviously. It relates to another doctrine, the doctrine of the resurrection. The creative activity in the creation account leads to the earth sprouting, vegetation, trees are planted, fish fill the seas, birds multiply on the earth, and so on and so forth. The text speaks about filling the earth. Now, days 1, 2, and 3 probably present to us sort of metaphorical receptacles, right? These places where things are put. It's like the metaphor may be that of the potter with clay. You put things in those vessels. But you don't overfill them, right? And the idea is that they're not underfilled either. There's actually a level, and you can see here a sense of what we call the balance of nature, right? That there is that equilibrium, which is actually God-given as part of the created order. So to develop environmental policies that lead to the overabundance of certain species and obviously the extinction of others is to go against creation. It gets better. There are some other examples that are important. Genesis chapter 2 presents God as a gardener and as a tree planter, a nice model for us. Now, on the second side of the handout, we'll wrap up now. There are some other examples that take us out of Genesis. So the law of Moses and the environment is an important one. We see that agricultural land was to lie fallow in the Sabbath years. Animals were to rest on Sabbath days as well as humans. There's a prohibition against felling fruit trees during extended sieges. Humane treatment of animals is also mandated. We see examples of God's care for animals in the Bible. Psalm 50, verse 10, the cattle on a thousand hills. Matthew 10, verse 29, God is concerned about even a little sparrow, right? And then at the same time, examples of notable individuals in the Bible who cared for animals. Moses, Jacob, David, they're all shepherds. Rebecca is presented watering camels. So we have some positive examples there. And then connecting a little bit with what my dad was saying earlier, at the bottom of the handout, we have these wonderful images of gardens and of the wilderness. Firstly, the second to last section, the wilderness and gardens as places and symbols of peace and spiritual renewal. Psalm 1, verse 3, very well-known example, where we see the righteous described as a tree flourishing by rivers of water. And that's an image that we also see in a slightly different way in Revelation 22 and verse 1. We also see in Isaiah chapter 35 the theme of Eden restored. And this is what I referred to earlier when I showed you the LL in-flight magazine advertisement. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God, etc. And then in Ezekiel chapter 47, we have language of a beautiful river and trees. And that language, I'll look this up as our last reference, Revelation chapter 22, comes at the very end of the Bible. Revelation talks about various points, the tree of life, certainly earlier in the letters to the ecclesias. But at the very end, we see another reference to the tree of life. So we come right back to Eden, right? We have this beautiful garden that's created for human beings to live in, to enjoy. And in a different sense, but also in a sense that connects with Eden, we have that in the future. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of it and on either side of the river was there the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nation. So it's a beautiful image that we're presented with here that tells us about the future and that, yes, God will restore the earth and will create a new Eden, an even better even Eden than in the first creation for us to enjoy. In the meantime, we need to make sure that we don't destroy that creation and be a part of those who are convicted of destroying the earth.